Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
Okay, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a very exciting program for you today. Kevin, why don't you tell us what's on the OR schedule for today?
On the podcast today, we are really excited to have Dr. John Cameron, professor of surgery and past chair at Johns Hopkins for 19 years. He's going to talk to us today about Dr. Halsted, pancreatic cancer, and the Whipple procedure. For our random fact of the day, we're going to explore a little known fact about Java. And for our tips and tricks, we're going to discuss pancreatic leaks with Dr. Cameron. And now to our opening shot.
So today's opening shot, we're going to focus on pancreatic adenocarcinoma. In the United States alone, pancreatic adenocarcinoma accounts for over 42,000 new cases annually. Unfortunately, more than 35,000 of these patients will die. This amounts to the fourth leading cause of cancer death in the United States. Even probably more concerning is the fact that only 15 to 20% of pancreatic adenocarcinomas are resectable at the time of diagnosis. So five-year survival rates, when you look at them, in those patients who have resectable disease, approximately 15 to 20% is a survival rate, but this drops way down to 3% when you combine all stages. Jay, what are some risk factors for pancreatic cancer?
Well, certainly it's more common in older ages. So advanced age has been associated with development of pancreatic cancer, as well as the male sex and black race. The strongest environmental factor that's been linked has been tobacco use. Interestingly, while chronic pancreatitis has shown some association, alcohol use itself is not. And then there's the hereditary disorders, such as the non-polyposis colon-rectal cancer diseases, the BRCA2 familial breast cancer, and some of the rarer ones to include ataxia telangiectasia and multiple mole melanoma, as well as hereditary pancreatitis.
Now, we talked a little bit about those patients who present with resectable disease being such a low number, Kevin. Tell me about the clinical presentation of these patients.
Yeah, and they generally present with anorexia, weight loss, abdominal discomfort, and nausea. If they're lucky, they may have some jaundice or acolic stools early, darkening of the urine, which would alert you to a biliary process, which would hopefully diagnose them earlier.
Now, a lot of people will say, if you have diabetes, does this lead to pancreatic cancer?
Not generally, but in up to 15% of the cases, a new onset of diabetes may be associated.
So it's not necessarily a causative factor, but maybe the first clinical feature in about 10 to 15% of these patients.
Correct.
What else is another one of these causes of acute presentation?
Occasionally, patients will present with acute pancreatitis, and this will be their first known onset of pancreatic cancer.
So, Jay, I got somebody that I suspect pancreatic adenocarcinoma. They come to me or they come to a primary care doc. What are the laboratory tests that we're going to get on these patients?
Of course, you want to check some LFTs, because if you have a mass at the head of the pancreas, you could have some obstructive labs, elevated bilirubin, elevated transaminitis. You want to check certainly their coags, because they could be coagulopathic, and this has been shown to be reversible with the administration of vitamin K, which is certainly you'd want to do if you were thinking you were headed towards some type of surgical intervention, and some tumor markers. So there's been many that have been investigated, but probably the most studied has been the CA19-9.
Regarding radiology testing, Kevin, what are the diagnostic imaging that's the mainstay of this, and kind of how do we use a diagnostic imaging to really guide us towards surgery?
Right, there's no perfect imaging test, but with a combination, there can be a great accuracy. So generally, you'll start with either an ultrasound or a CT scan, which will show a mass on the pancreas, and then you can further define that with something such as an ERCP or an MRCP to get further anatomy details.
Jason, one of the things that's done a lot in our institution is the endoscopic ultrasound, and how does that work, and where does it fit a role in these patients?
Sure. Well, I think it's important to note that the primary method of diagnosis, the CT scan, specifically the thin-cut pancreas protocol CT, which is pretty sensitive. EUS does play some role. It can be used in the clarification of small lesions less than 2 centimeters when the CT findings are questionable or negative, and in order to perform a guided fine needle aspiration if definitive diagnosis and staging is necessary. However, it is very important to note, biopsy is not needed prior to resection.
Now, what do you think about the CAT scan? What are you really looking for? So we're looking for a mass of that CAT scan. What else are we looking for?
Well, the big thing you want to see is if there's metastatic disease. If you want to see the peritoneum, the liver, you're going to see if this is a resectable tumor or not.
And how do we gauge that resectability in many cases?
Well, generally, we're looking at the vessels to see if there's local invasion. You look at your SMA and your celiac axis and your portal vein.
And that's something that we're going to get into with Dr. Cameron a little bit later in our dissection of the day. So, Jay, when you look at all comers of pancreatic cancer, specifically from a surgery standpoint or, you know, overall, how can we stratify these patients into different groups?
A lot can be based on the preoperative or on the imaging itself. Patients with pancreatic cancer can be stratified really into three distinct groups. First, you have your metastatic patients. This is defined by CT scan. It shows evidence of distal metastasis to the liver, peritoneum, or the lung. Then you have the group that falls into the locally advanced, which shows CT evidence of arterial encroachment of the celiac axis or the SMA, or venous involvement or inclusion of superior mesenteric or portal veins. And then there are the potentially resectable group, which is defined as no CT evidence of extrapancreatic disease, a patent superior mesenteric vein and portal vein confluence, and no evidence of direct tumor extension to the celiac axis or the SMA.
Yeah, I think with the newer imaging modalities in those thin-cut slices that we talked about, that's really goes to the heart of these patients in determining who can we take for an operation and who would be best served by just medical management alone. And we're going to get into that with Dr. Cameron a little bit later. Mm-hmm. So Kevin, let's focus now on the operative management of these patients. When we look at resectability, oftentimes I read about in the past that staging laparoscopy was used in some centers. What is the current thought process about that?
It's really gone out of favor with the improved imaging. We can generally know before we go into the abdomen whether there's going to be metastatic disease.
What are they trying to look for, though? I mean, we talked about these three stratification groups in there, but is there something if you're not only the relationship of mass itself with the vessels, with the SMV and the SMA, but what else are we looking for on the imaging studies in terms of local spread?
Well, there can be very small liver metastasis or peritoneal spread that can't be less than 1 centimeter, you know, things like that, that won't be picked up by the CT.
And what about the mainstay of surgery? What is the operation called and what are we really going after and what does it consist of?
Well, you know, the main thing is when we really talk about adenocarcinoma, we're mainly talking about pancreatic head masses. And the surgery for that is the pancreaticoduodenectomy or the Whipple procedure. There's, you know, different types. There's pylorus preserving versus the classic Whipple where you take the pylorus and do a distal gastrectomy. There's different methods for restoring the continuity. And there are several different techniques that can be used for reestablishing the pancreaticoenteric anastomosis. These are all things we're going to go into in detail a little bit later with Dr. Cameron.
Yeah, and again, even with optimal surgical management, the 5-year survival goes down to 15 to 20%. And, you know, adjuvant therapy is kind of taking a role as well as neoadjuvant therapy, and we're very excited to discuss this with the different protocols and the future protocols in there. But in terms of different adjuvant ones, gemcitabine, 5-FU, radiation therapy, we're going to delve into that again in our dissection of the day. Unfortunately, there is a significant amount of patients that present too late. And Kevin, in terms of just a pure palliative type approach, what options do we have out there for palliation for these particular patients that are non-resectable or obviously, they can't undergo a potentially curative surgical procedure?
Right. Well, it largely depends on what their symptoms are. If their main symptom is abdominal pain, you can discuss getting a celiac block, nervous plexus, to relieve the pain. If they have a biliary obstruction or bowel obstruction, you can do different bypass procedures to relieve that.
So what about, Jay, for those patients who have obstructive jaundice as a major component of it and are just very, you know, itching all the time and are just pretty miserable?
Yeah, this is where you may be able to get a little assistance from gastroenterology and placing some either endoscopic stents or from interventional radiology in placing some percutaneous biliary stents.
And what about in terms of nutrition and feeding, Kevin? Anything we can do in those patients who have from a palliative type approach for unresectable ones?
You can put a feeding jejunostomy in them to keep their nutritional status up.
Yeah, again, like most cancers, especially with more locally advanced and late stage cancers, nutrition is a major player of that. And to be able to, you know, not only relieve the obstruction, but to be able to give these patients a quality of life is paramount importance. So we're really excited, and join us a little bit later on in our dissection of the day as we talk with Dr. John Cameron, who's one of the surgical pioneers who helped revolutionize the treatment of this and obviously has a broad experience and a very large expertise in the treatment of this disease.
You know what that music means. It's time for our random fact of the day. Kevin, what random fact do you have for us today?
Today we're going to learn how to decaffeinate coffee beans.
Interesting.
Wait a second. They come caffeinated?
Yeah, that's how nature makes them. But there is a way to get the caffeine out.
I guess I always just assumed that it was part of like the growing process when you grow the beans, but it's not?
No, it's a chemical process. They're chemically processing and hurting your beans. And the way they do this is you have a processor that uses water and steam to swell the green beans before they're roasted. And then they extract the caffeine using a solvent. Normally it's ethyl acetate and methylene chloride. And then the other option to do is you can have highly pressurized carbon dioxide strip the caffeine away from the beans, which are then steamed to remove any solvent residues. And then they're dried and roasted as coffee traditionally is.
So does this get all the coffee out, or all the caffeine out, or?
No, it doesn't. It gets most of it out. There's only about 2.5% of the caffeine left. That's the standard in the United States. But actually, in Europe, they have a stricter standard. It can only have 0.1% to be called decaf beans.
So then what do they do with the caffeine once they get it out of the coffee? Like make crystal meth with it or something?
No, what they actually do with this caffeine is they actually sell it. There's a lot of people that want to use it in their 5-hour energies and their energy drinks. And so this caffeine has quite the market to be sold afterwards.
All right.
I can hear your caffeine almost being ready right now.
All right. Well, there you have it. That was our random fact of the day.
Okay, we are very excited today. I'm behind the knife to have Dr. John Cameron, the Alfred Blalock Distinguished Professor of Surgery at Johns Hopkins University of Medicine and the former chair of surgery at Johns Hopkins for 19 years. And so, sir, we've read a lot about your accomplishments in pancreatic surgery, but could you tell us a little bit about where you grew up and your path to surgery?
Sure. I grew up in Michigan. My father was a surgeon. He initially, before World War II, was a general practitioner in Brighton, Michigan, a small town about 40 miles outside Detroit. Then he went into World War II, and he went in as what's called a 3150 because he'd had some surgical training. And so he did surgery for 5 years during World War II. And when he came out, he decided he wanted to complete his surgical training. So we moved from Brighton to Detroit. And he continued his surgical training at Wayne State University Receiving Hospital, and then went into first full-time at Wayne State University in the Department of Surgery, and then part-time. So I grew up with a father who was a surgeon, and back in my generation, people pretty much did what their father did. If he was an electrician, you went and you became an electrician. If he was a lawyer, you became a lawyer. So I didn't have to struggle and decide and debate what I wanted to go into. I wanted to be a surgeon. And so I went to college at Harvard and medical school at Hopkins and did my surgical training at Hopkins, and I've been here ever since.
Did your dad, back in the days when you were growing up, did you see your dad a lot? I mean, obviously, we joke now about the residency work hours and things like that, but what was it like growing up the son of a surgeon kind of in those times? How much
was
your dad?
It was terrific. I mean, sure, he worked a lot, but that's a good role model
right. For
children. If you have a parent or both parents, I think it's even better if both parents work. They're good role models. They're good examples of how you ought to lead your life. So, sure, he worked hard.
Absolutely.
And he worked 7 days a week, but that instilled me a work ethic that I still have today.
So, sir, you did your training at Hopkins and in education at Hopkins. And so fast forward me to the time where, having trained there and having been there, it's your first day where you moved into the chair of the chair office at Hopkins. Considering the history of that institution, and what was it like that day to continue in the legacy of Dr. Halstead?
Well, it was terrific, and I still treasure those 19 years that I was the chief of surgery here. It was terrific. There was, you know, I had been on the faculty here at Hopkins. I finished my training in 1970, and this was 14 years later, in 1984. I was one of several candidates, and when I got the job, it was fantastic. It was a celebration that lasted 19 years. People kept asking me, what did you do to celebrate getting the chair? And I said, I'm celebrating it every day, and the celebration won't stop until the chairmanship stops. So it was something that I valued and loved very much.
Sir, thinking back on Dr. Halstead's legacy and who he was and what he did, and then looking at today's surgical training, what do you think that he would be excited and impressed about today's surgical training, and what would he be disappointed about?
Oh, well, I don't think he'd be disappointed about anything. He, of course, if you ask 10 sports writers who is the best baseball player this country has ever produced, they would say Babe Ruth, Ty Cobb, Willie Mays, Joe DiMaggio. There would be a list of probably six or eight. There wouldn't be one individual. Mm-hmm. There wouldn't be unanimous agreement. But if you ask 10 medical historians who is the most important, innovative, and influential surgeon this country has produced, it's unanimous. It's Dr. Halstead. So he's really unique, and surgical residency training is only one of his many contributions. Mm-hmm. And he would be delighted with the training programs today. The training programs today are terrific. They need to be adjusted, but training programs in every field need to be adjusted, need to be adaptive, need to change with the changing requirements of the field. So I think he would be pleased and delighted that with our training programs.
So you talked about the celebration of those 19 years. What was your greatest challenge? And although this might be a little bit difficult to ask, but was there something, some sort of an achievement or achievements that stood out during that time where you, during your time as the chief of surgery for at Hopkins?
Well, this surgical training program, from the beginning, its mission was to train the best possible technical surgeons, the best possible investigators, both laboratory and clinical, and the best possible teachers, and have them leave, not to stay here indefinitely, but to leave and lead institutions around the country. That was one of Dr. Halstead's greatest legacies. And during my 19 years, there have been 15, 16, 17 people who have left this institution to lead surgery departments around the country and to sort of carry the message and the legacy of this institution elsewhere. And I think that's the greatest accomplishment that I had. It was continuing the legacies of providing surgical leadership for the country.
In challenges, sir, was there anything that kind of stood out in terms of some of the greater challenges during that course?
Well, I mean, these jobs are always challenging because programs have to be flexible and adaptive. When I first started as chairman here, we used to have retreats and have five-year planning programs. But soon, that I saw the fallacy of that. You can't plan out what's going to happen in the next 5 years and set goals. You have to be adaptive, because something happens every day that means you've got to change your surgical training program, you've got to change your surgical practice. So it's a challenge every day. And again, programs that are successful are adaptive and flexible and able to change with the times. And the times change every day.
Absolutely.
Great, sir. At our program, current surgical therapy is a standard issue for all residents. And I was wondering if you could discuss with us the editorial experience with this and how the text has evolved.
Well, it's been a terrific experience, and that's been one of my joys over the last 11 editions, and we're starting to work on the 12th edition right now. Like most books, it wasn't my idea. It was a publisher's idea. There was a text, and I think there still is a text, called Surgical Therapy, which covers all of medicine. It was Kahn's current therapy. And I think it comes out every year or at least every 2 years, but I think every year. And the publisher of that left, I think, Saunders, and went out on his own and decided every field needs a current therapy. Mm-hmm. So he started current gastrointestinal medicine therapy, current orthopedic therapy, etc., and he came to me with the idea of current surgical therapy, and he wanted me to do it every year. And I said, you know, that's crazy. I'm not going to do it every year. But let me do it once, and if it finds a niche and it's accepted by the surgical community, maybe I'll do it every 3 or 4 years. Well, with the first edition, it was successful. So we sort of discussed back and forth and came upon a 3-year cycle so that now for the last 30 years or so, I start with getting a list of contributors, and there are roughly 280 chapters in it. And I changed the contributors every edition. So every 3 years, I'd sit down and make a list and then write each of them and write a personal note below it. And from the beginning, we've gotten almost 80 or 90%, 95% acceptance with the first letter. So that's the first year. The second year, they send the chapters in, and I edit them. And editing 280 chapters on the various general surgical topics keeps me up to date. And when I go visit someplace and some bright surgical resident tries to present a case to stump me, chances are I've read a chapter on that. I've edited a chapter on that in the last year or two, and so it keeps me up to date. And in the third year, I get to rest, and we don't have to work on it. And then after a 1 year rest, I start working on a new list of authors, trying to change every single author on every chapter. So it's been terrific. Now, in the last issue or two, I'm 78 years old now. I still work full-time 7 days a week. I still operate 3 days a week. But I don't know a lot of the young surgeons in the country. My son, who is also a surgeon, obviously is much younger, and knows the young surgeons around the country, so he's joined as a co-editor. And so now, instead of me doing it all by myself, he and I split it, and I think we have a broader age range to pick from now, since he knows most of the young academic surgeons in the country. But it's been a great treat to be involved with current surgical therapy. It's been terrific.
And that's one of the things we want to touch on, sir. So considering your...
And the other thing, let me add another thing. When I visit around the country, other institutions, people come up and don't say, oh my God, you were chief at Hopkins or this or that, or you've done a lot of Whipples. They say current surgical therapy. I don't think anybody'd know my name if it weren't for current surgical therapy.
Well, it's gotten a lot of us through our board, sir. So
right.
you know, considering the legacy of your dad and then to you both being surgeons, what was it like, you know, not only to have your son join you on the textbook, but to see his evolution, his career, and probably, you know, the impact along those lines?
It is terrific. It is terrific. We both here are in the same department of surgery here at Hopkins. I obviously don't see him every day, but at Grand Rounds and Mortality and Morbidity Conference, I see him, and every once in a while I run into him in the hall. And we talk about current patients, et cetera. I also have a daughter who works at Hopkins, who's a faculty member at the School of Hygiene and Public Health. She has her PhD in epidemiology. So two of our four kids and five of our seven grandchildren are right here in Baltimore. So every Sunday evening, the whole clan, 10 or 11 of us, get together at our house for dinner. So our family is fairly close-knit, and we see a lot of each other, and it's terrific.
Sir, you're obviously well-known for your treatment of the advances in the surgical treatment of pancreatic cancer. You can't Google Whipple without the name John Cameron popping up. How did you decide to focus your career around pancreatic cancer?
Well, when I trained here at Hopkins, we had a combined training program in that at the end of this six-year program, you qualified for both general surgery and thoracic surgery boards. So I'm boarded in both. There wasn't a separate fellowship that you had to take back in that era. So when I started my practice, I did everything. I did pulmonary resections. I did vascular surgery. I did a ton of breast surgery. And I did GI surgery. So I did it all. And then in 1984, when I became chairman here, I decided I needed to recruit a lot of people. Divisions were just starting. Specialties were being developed. And to recruit an esophageal surgeon, I did all the esophageal surgery at that time. I had to tell him, I'm going to give you all the esophageal surgery. And then I'd recruit a vascular surgeon and said, I'm not going to do any more vascular surgery. So gradually my practice got narrowed. At that time, out in the community, nobody wanted to do pancreatic cancer surgery because those patients leaked or got septic or got sick and died, and it wasn't good for their practice. And in addition, I wanted to pick something, a project for the department there was a lot of room for improvement so that the department could be known for something. So I picked pancreatic cancer and the Whipple procedure. And gradually, over the years, we became the highest volume pancreatic surgery center in the world. I think we still are now. So that was a focus that I picked because there was so much need and room for improvement that I thought it would give the department a project during my tenure.
So, sir, we're going to transition now into the section that we call the dissection of the day. This is where we focus on a particular topic, and today's topic is we couldn't have you on without focusing on the Whipple procedure and about pancreatic cancer. So we know about the preoperative workup of pancreatic cancer and the use of imaging to determine who's resectable, who's not resectable, but, sir, how do you deal with that patient that's maybe borderline resectable, especially as it pertains to the abutment of the vessels and potentially needing a vascular reconstruction? How do you make that determination to be able to say, yep, I'm going to go for that, or this is a patient that would be better off without surgery?
Well, it's sort of a joint decision. We have a radiologist here named Elliot Fishman who developed the software for the three-dimensional CAT scan. That was his contribution. And his specialty is the pancreas. And so I get together virtually daily with Elliot Fishman to go over CAT scans that are sent from around the country. And we decide jointly, and often we do this at a multidisciplinary conference that includes medical oncologists also, what the best way to manage this patient is that we're looking at his or her CAT scan. And obviously, if the patient is clearly resectable on the CAT scan, we go ahead and do surgery first. MD Anderson, Fox Chase, and a few others have really treated almost all resectable patients with neoadjuvant therapy. But we still think that if the patient is clearly resectable, you should do the surgery first and rely upon adjuvant therapy. Now, that may change someday in the future when we have chemotherapy that's really effective. At that time, I think it might become like rectal cancer, and virtually everybody gets neoadjuvant therapy before you do the surgery. But that's not the case today. So if they're clearly resectable, we go ahead and resect them. And then postoperative, now there are reasonable regimens for adjuvant therapy. We have a vaccine that is often used. We still believe radiotherapy, particularly stereotactic radiotherapy, which is only a 5-day course, are useful. But the most important adjuvant therapy is chemotherapy, and we use one of three regimens. The first regimen that we use that we think is the best is FOLFIRINOX, a four-drug regimen. The second is GEMSAR and Abraxane. And the third is GTX, GEMSAR, a Taxol derivative, and Zoloda. Now, many oncologists still want to use just GEMSAR because it's safe, it's non-toxic, mm-hmm. and patients tolerate it well. But it's practically a placebo. There's very little data to support its prolongation of survival. So we think these other regimens that haven't been demonstrated to be a benefit with prospective randomized series in the adjuvant setting, we feel strongly that they should definitely be used in the adjuvant setting. Now, for the patient who is borderline resectable, it all depends. You know, if they're it's 180 degrees up against the superior mesenteric vein, but there's no distortion of the vein, and it just looks like it's up against it, we often will go ahead and do surgery first in that, with them. But if it distorts the vein or distorts the superior mesenteric artery, then they are candidates for neoadjuvant therapy, and again, the first choice is FOLFIRINOX. And we also often give them stereotactic radiotherapy. You know, the point where if a patient is margin positive post-op is along the superior mesenteric artery. It's where the uncinate process comes up against the artery. And if you use stereotactic radiotherapy and have fiducials or else at the time of surgery put clips along the SMA, they can focus the radiotherapy over a short period of time right along that area which can be positive, is most at risk for positive. So I think there's a lot of good time and good sense. Now, if somebody clearly is unresectable, then they're treated, obviously, with palliation. And again, FOLFIRINOX in that setting has clearly been demonstrated in a prospective randomized study from France, published in the New England Journal of Medicine several years ago, to be of benefit. And that study, interestingly, was compared to GEMSAR alone. And the, even though many oncologists, medical oncologists today, are reluctant, if they haven't had a lot of experience, to give FOLFIRINOX, in that prospective randomized study, the quality of life was actually better in the FOLFIRINOX group than in the GEMSAR group. So It's become really, with a proper use, a fairly safe adjuvant, neoadjuvant, or palliative therapy.
Have you seen much of, similar to kind of the rectal cancer literature, of taking somebody from a APR to a sphincter reconstruction, of giving somebody that you thought was unresectable, getting them some neoadjuvant, or in this case, obviously some what you may consider palliative, and converting them into somebody who is resectable?
Yep.
Is that a rare event? Is that, you know,
I wouldn't say it's rare. I would say it's unusual.
Okay.
To convert somebody from borderline to resectable is common.
Okay.
To convert somebody from unresectable to borderline or resectable is unusual, but definitely happens.
Okay.
Great, sir. In those patients that do need vascular reconstruction, do you guys involve vascular surgery or do the pancreatic surgeons take care of that?
You know, it varies. We have, I would say, we have five surgeons here who do a lot of, we do someplace between 250 and 300 Whipples a year.
Wow.
So we have, I would say, five surgeons here at the main hospital at Hopkins who are experienced pancreatic surgeons. Some of them use the liver transplanters, who obviously anastomose arteries and portal veins and superior mesenteric veins every day. Some use vascular surgeons, and some do it themselves. And it pretty much all depends. If you have a short segment of portal vein or superior mesenteric vein that needs to come out, I think most pancreatic surgeons here are capable of doing an end-to-end anastomosis. But if it's more complicated, I think the usual plan is to have one of the transplant surgeons available or one of the vascular surgeons.
Now, sir, you're known for contributing to making this a safe operation, but nonetheless, it is can be a difficult procedure. It can be a difficult postoperative course for the patient, and it can have some morbidity. How do you go about counseling these patients preoperatively for resection?
Well, what patients want to know is they're going to die from the operation because they've heard from general practitioners, family physicians, internists, gastroenterologists that it's a dangerous operation. So when they come in, they want to know, are they going to die? Is there a risk of dying? And I can tell them that I've done over 2,000, and the hospital mortality is less than 2%. It's about 1.5%. And that reassures them. And then I tell them complications are common, but they're not life-threatening. Mm-hmm. What they do is keep you in the hospital a little longer. And that's pretty much all most patients want to know. They don't want to know about pancreatic fistulas and delayed gastric hemorrhage. They don't even want to hear it. I mean, if they do, if they ask about them, I tell them. But they want to know whether they're going to live or die from this operation because many of them have been scared by what they've been told before they come in. And about complications, I say they're not life-threatening. They're going to keep you in the hospital longer, but they're not going to risk your life. And that's pretty much everything they want to know. Now, having said that, today, when a patient is told by, say, a gastroenterologist, you have pancreatic cancer, they go home and they tell their family. And one of their kids, or more often even one of their grandchildren, looks up pancreatic cancer on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
And they print it out and go show it to their granddad or grandmother. And those patients come in knowing as much about pancreatic cancer as I do. So you don't have to explain as much. The Internet is a marvelous tool, not only for patients to find the place to go, but to educate them about what the operation is like. And on our website, there's actually a video that they can watch that shows, that has me narrating some drawings of exactly what takes place during a Whipple operation.
Do you feel there's a role or anyone for preoperative biliary decompression? And if so, who do you choose? And do you use the ERCP route, the PTC route, or due to the risk of sepsis, do you just try to avoid that altogether?
Well, the problem is most patients that get referred have already been decompressed. They've already seen a gastroenterologist and a gastroenterologist who can do an ERCP is like somebody who has a hammer. Everything looks like a nail, and they use it. And so almost all patients come in with decompressed via ERCP. But if they don't, and I can do them within a week, and they're not being driven crazy by pruritus, we won't decompress them. I say, are you bothered by the jaundice? If you are, we can get you decompressed tomorrow. If not, if you can hold off for a week, we won't have to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And it all depends. If they're, you know, scratching and being driven crazy, they want to be decompressed. If not, we don't decompress them.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe 5% of patients come in and we can do them within a week and they don't get decompressed. But again, most patients referred have seen a gastroenterologist, so they're already decompressed.
Great, sir. And your group was one of the first to publish a large series that showed a low morbidity and zero mortality in patients 30 days after a Whipple. Can you describe what techniques you guys developed that changed the Whipple procedure to make it safe?
You know, that's a good question, but and I don't have an answer for it, because I've done, as I mentioned, over 2,000. Now, you might think, if you look back at my series, which started in 1969-70, I think it's when I did the first one, you might think the first 100, I'd have a mortality of 25%, which was the mortality worldwide. And the second 100, maybe 22. The third 120, etc. My first 100 is the same mortality as my last 100. So I didn't go through an evolutionary phase of learning how to do the operation and gradually lowering the mortality. My mortality was low from the beginning, and that's true for the other surgeons here at Hopkins who I recruited. You know, initially when I was chair, I recruited Mike Zinner, who is currently at the Brigham as chief of surgery, Henry Pitt, and others. And their mortality was the same. We all started out with a low mortality. So I think just using Halstedian principles of being careful, maintaining hemostasis, using those principles, it was the time for that operation's mortality to be lowered. I don't think we were innovative in initiating new techniques or whatever. I think we use careful surgical technique, number one, and number two, we drain the anastomoses carefully. The reason that the operation carried a 25% mortality back in the 80s and 90s was that the pancreatic anastomosis would leak, they would develop an abscess, they would bleed, and start a downward cycle, which ended in death for one out of every four patients.
Mm-hmm.
We, from the beginning, drained the anastomoses carefully so that if the pancreatic anastomosis leaked, there was it was a controlled leak out of drain. You know, if using drains and putting them right on an anastomosis increases the leak rate, and our leak rate for pancreatic fistulas is not low. If anything, it's a tiny bit on the high side. But the leaks are all controlled, mm-hmm. out closed suction silastic drains. And they keep the patient in the hospital a little longer, but they're not life-threatening. And I think just careful technique and good, careful drainage with closed suction drains makes the difference.
Sir, do you perform a staging laparoscopy on all patients? And
no, nobody does that anymore.
So
that's a waste of time. Elliot Fishman's three-dimensional CAT scan makes it so if you think a patient's resectable and the CAT scan is clear and it's pancreatic cancer, they're resectable 90% of the time. If it's distal bowel duct, ampullary, or duodenal, they're resectable virtually 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. So it's a waste of time, money, and resources to do laparoscopy.
And also, do you perform a pylorus preserving or the classic Whipple?
Both. We prefer pylorus preserving, but if the tumor is closer, there's a positive margin, or for technical reasons, it's going to be a little harder to maintain blood supplies to the first portion of the duodenum. We do a really distal gastrectomy. I would say 60 or 70% of the time we do pylorus preserving, and the rest of the time we do a gastrectomy. But it's not a heme gastrectomy like used to be performed. We probably take out 10 or at most 15% of the antrum or of the stomach. The only time we do a hemigastrectomy is if you do a total pancreatectomy. You take most of the blood supply to the stomach, and so you've got to take out the distal stomach or else you're going to be worried about ischemia at the gastrojejunostomy. But otherwise, when we don't do pylorus preserving, it's a very small gastrectomy.
So, Dr. Cameron, there's obviously a little bit more stressful parts to every procedure. After 2,000-plus Whipples, is performing a Whipple like riding a bike to you, or are there still parts of the procedure that kind of raise your blood pressure?
You know, I do everyone worried I'm going to hurt the patient. I'm going to injure the portal vein, injure the superior mesenteric artery, and I go in and am very, very cautious and am worried that I'm going to make a mistake. And that keeps me on my toes 100% of the time so that that rarely happens. But I don't think you ever become complacent about any operative procedure. I don't think you should.
No.
I think you should be compulsive and fastidious and worried that you're going to forget something or make a mistake.
So, just going back, because I want to clarify for those listening out there, can you give us a little bit more detail about your drains? What drains do you pick? Where do you exactly place them? Kind of, is that the same for every particular case, or does it vary depending on the anatomy or anything like that? Because it's such a useful tip.
Well, for the first 1,000, I didn't have a leak from a duodenal jejunostomy or gastrojejunostomy. So I think you don't have to drain the enteric anastomosis.
Mm-hmm.
And the biliary anastomoses leak 1% of the time. Now, frequently, for the first day or day and a half, there'll be some bilious drainage, but that always stops. It's sort of from needle holes. But 1% of the time, 1 out of 100, the biliary anastomosis leaks. So that's probably high enough that you need to drain the biliary anastomosis. Now, the pancreatic anastomosis, if it's a firm gland, a big duct, the leak rate is very, very low. But it's not zero. Again, it's probably 4 or 5%. If it's a soft pancreas with a normal-sized duct, the leak rate is going to be 20 or 30%.
Mm-hmm.
So it's obviously the pancreatic and the biliary anastomosis you have to drain. And if we use 2 Blake silastic closed suction drains. One goes right underneath the pancreas. One goes right on top of the anastomosis. And they're right on the anastomosis. So they promote leakage. And therefore, we have a higher leak rate than a lot of institutions. But it's out the drain, and the only way you know it is by measuring the amylase in the drainage, and it may be 2,000, so you know you've got a little leak. And you just leave the drain there, and eventually it closes. They all close spontaneously. You never have to reoperate on them. And both drains are brought out underneath the hepatic anastomosis, the hepaticojejunostomy. So 2 silastic closed suction Blake drains, one on top, one below the pancreaticojejunostomy, and both come out underneath the hepaticojejunostomy through separate stab wounds in the right side of the abdomen. And if you get a leak, the only way you know it is the amylase in the effluent is elevated.
Mm-hmm.
They're not sick, and they all close spontaneously.
What's your criteria for pulling the drains?
Well, either low, very low volume, and by low volume I mean 20 cc's or less, or low amylase. And by low amylase I mean serum amylase.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're putting 400 cc's out each drain, but the amylase is 70, we take them out.
Mm-hmm.
If the amylase is 20,000 in each drain, but they're each putting out 15 cc's, we take them out. So they either have to have low amylase, low volume, or both.
Gotcha. What's your approach to postoperative management in these patients with regard to fluids? When do you feed them? Discharge criteria? Are there advanced?
Here's the routine.
Yep.
I tell each patient this, you're operated upon. You go to the intensive care unit for the first night, whether you need to or not. You go there so that we can watch you carefully. The next day, post-operative day one, you're out of bed ambulating. The nasogastric tube is taken out, and you're given sips and chips. You go to the floor later that day. Post-operative day two, you're given clear liquids and more ambulation. If you tolerate that well, day three, you can have a regular diet. If you don't tolerate it well, we'll keep you on full liquids or clear liquids. But if you're doing well, you go to a regular diet. Day four, we take out one of your drains. Day five, we take out the second drain. And you can go home or leave the hospital as early as day six. But I tell them, most patients, the average length of stay is 8 days. So you have to figure 8 days. And then most of my patients are from out of state. And I tell them, you have to go to a hotel, a motel in Baltimore, or the hospital has a facility across the street, which is very inexpensive. And you have to stay in Baltimore for 3 or 4 days and then come back to see me so I can be sure you're doing all right on your own and your incision is okay. And then if you're okay, you can go home. So they have to figure on being in Baltimore for about 2 weeks.
Okay.
And I tell that to each patient, and that's the protocol.
Great.
That's the critical pathway.
And I know Johns Hopkins is very much on the forefront of advancements in pancreatic adenocarcinoma. Can you discuss some of the things that are exciting to you about the future direction involving vaccines, tumor markers? Yes.
Well, their progress is constant, but very, very slow. We have more clinical investigators, more basic scientists working on pancreatic cancer. We have more funding, and we have a $30 million endowment on all this to support research on pancreatic cancer. It's the biggest pancreatic cancer unit, to my knowledge, in the world. And what we need is, what the greatest needs for in the battle against pancreatic cancer is, number one, a tumor marker, like PSA for prostate. But we need it worse for pancreatic cancer, so that people age 40 and above, when they go get their annual physical exam, they get a tumor marker sent off. And if it's positive, then they have to have a CAT scan, they have to be, you know, ultrasound, they have to have maybe even an ERCP. But that's the greatest need, because the disease becomes systemic very early in its course. And we need to pick these patients up before they turn yellow, before they become jaundiced, or before they lose 20 pounds, or before they develop back pain. So that's number one. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of work being done here and around the world on trying to identify a tumor marker. And the second thing we need, since it is systemic disease early on, we need better neoadjuvant therapy. And, you know, it's chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and immunotherapy. And there are slow, steady advances being made in both of those areas. We so far have had sort of bunt singles. FOLFIRINOX, I think, can be classified as a solid single or maybe even a double. But what we need are some home runs. And I'm convinced they're on the way, that we just haven't had one yet.
So, sir, we're going to transition now to our segment called Tips and Tricks, and today we're going to focus on pancreatic leaks. You know, you mentioned earlier talking about kind of how you handle your drains and everything to deal with this intraoperatively and perioperatively, but let's say you have a patient who the drains are out or is transferred into your institution, or who comes in, status post Whipple procedure, and he's got the rising enzymes, you get the CTs, the peripancreatic fluid collection, and there's suspicion for a leak. How do you approach this particular patient?
Well, obviously, if it's drainable, first of all, if the patient is symptomatic, if they either have pain, they have a high white count, or they're febrile, it has to be managed. If they're asymptomatic and have a 3 centimeter collection near the pancreatic or jejunostomy, we probably wouldn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
We'd just follow them.
No antibiotics.
But if they have a fever, a white count, or symptomatic, they need to be drained. And if they can be percutaneously drained in the cath lab, the ARB, then that's what happens. Now, frequently, if it's a small collection, it's not accessible percutaneously. You'd have to go through colon or through the stomach to get to it. And in those instances, they're best drained endoscopically by endoscoping them and in the stomach using a ultrasound probe and identifying the collection and then draining the collection into the stomach. But that's not common. I mean, that would be identified in our patients, obviously, before they left the hospital. Everybody pretty much gets a CAT scan before they leave the hospital.
Are you putting these patients on NPO, TPN, or do you allow them to eat through this portion of it?
If they're eating and drinking, sure, they can continue.
Okay.
You know, we put our patients on octreotide occasionally if they have a collection. You know, octreotide has been looked at in prospective randomized studies, and except for one or two questionable studies from Europe, a big study from here and a big study from MD Anderson demonstrates octreotide is of no value in preventing a leak. Now, there's an octreotide, a somatostatin analog, that's been studied in a prospective randomized study from Memorial that was published in New England Journal several months ago that suggests that this new analog will decrease the incidence of pancreatic fissures.
Mm-hmm.
So there may be some help on the way there, but generally, when somebody comes back with a collection and they're drained and there's output, we'll put them on octreotide then.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's a noticeable decrease in the output.
Great.
But again, they all will eventually close spontaneously.
Great. One last technical point, kind of on the area of pancreatic fissures. When you're doing your pancreatic anastomosis, are you using a mucosa to mucosa or an invagination technique?
What I do is do an end of the pancreas to the side of the jejunum. I use a stent, a silastic stent, and it's either a 3, 5, or 8 pediatric feeding tube, French 3, 5, or 8. And most with a dilated duct, you put an 8 in. And I take an 8-centimeter length of it, put 4 centimeters into the pancreatic duct, make a jejunotomy, and put the other 4 centimeters into the jejunal loop, and then use 5-0 Vicryl to do a mucosa to jejunotomy anastomosis, and then the outer layer is interrupted 3-0 silk Lambert sutures. And I do that virtually every pancreatic anastomosis.
Well, your technique...
The stent, I'm not sure, decreases the leak rate. But if you do get a leak, you know you have a communication between the pancreatic duct and the jejunum, and you know it's going to heal.
Mm-hmm. So you had talked about a little bit earlier about the differences between a hard and a soft pancreas. Does anything in your whole process, in terms of your Whipple procedure technique, vary based on the consistency of the pancreas? Is it pretty much straightforward?
Well, it's the same,
mm-hmm.
whether it's... I mean, occasionally, when we have a really atrophic pancreas with a duct that's 1.5 centimeters in diameter, you know that gland is not going to leak. It's not going to leak for three reasons. First of all, it's so atrophic, it's not making much pancreatic juice. Number two, it holds sutures well because it's atrophic and fibrotic. And number three, the anastomosis is huge because the duct is dilated. I don't think you need to leave drains behind mm-hmm. in that instance. So that would be the only difference.
Okay. Great, sir. Now we're going to move on to our final five. This is the final portion of our interview here, and we're going to just ask you five questions. And the first one we're going to start off with is, do you play music in the operating room? And if so, what type of music?
Well, I'm not a huge music fan in or out of the operating room, but I'm not opposed to it. And depending upon the house staff and the nursing staff, if they want to have music in the background, I say fine, go ahead. So I'm not for it or against it, but when somebody wants it, I accept it.
Number two, tell us any talents, interests, or special hobbies outside of medicine, outside of the operating room that that you like a lot.
Well, I play a lot of golf. In the spring, summer, fall in Baltimore, it's very pleasant weather. And I often will play on... I spend half of Saturday and half of Sunday in the hospital. So I have Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon to, you know, do something with the family or friends. And I often play golf Saturday afternoon and Sunday afternoon. Saturday afternoon with people from the hospital, Sunday afternoon with my son and daughter who live in Baltimore, work at Hopkins, and one of their spouses. So I play golf. We have a home up in New England, a summer home, and we go up there 5 times a year. And when we're up there, I play golf. I ski. And those are the two pretty much sports activities. I used to play tennis, but once I got into golf, I let that go. So that's sort of my lifestyle. It's been in the hospital with the family or playing golf or skiing.
Now, sir, can you share us your handicap and what type of irons do you use? Are you a Callaway guy or what are we talking here?
Well, I use Callaway irons and TaylorMade woods. When you're 78, the worst thing that happens is you lose muscle mass and you can't hit the ball very far. 10 years ago, before this started happening, when I was still late 60s or 70, I was down to about 11 handicap. Now I'm up to 17 and about to transition into senior tees. So I've not been particularly good, but I love the sport.
But you get that reproducible swing and it's right down the middle instead of being three off the tee. That's the nice thing.
That is true. That is true. I've always been accused of hitting it down the middle, so you're right about that. Straight is long.
Yes, sir. So our third question, what has been the single greatest innovation in surgery you've seen during your career?
Well, I think probably minimally invasive surgery. I think that's changed the face of surgery the most. When I was a medical student here, closed chest massage, CPR, was being developed here at Hopkins. And as a medical student, in the last 2 summers, I had a lab up on the 12th floor of this building I'm in now, the Blalock building. And Jude Cohenhoven and Knickerbocker were developing CPR, closed section, in dogs. And the way they did it, the electric companies around the country had hired a electrical engineer from Hopkins to try and figure out how to defibrillate people, their workers up on poles who were being shocked and sent into V-fib. So this group, including Jim Jude, a surgeon, well-known surgeon who trained under Dr. Blalock, they were fibrillating dogs and trying to defibrillate them. Well, once a dog fibrillated early before they were ready to defibrillate him, and so Jim Jude took his fist and pounded the chest of the dog trying to defibrillate him by pounding the chest. And the dog had an arterial line in, and they noticed that when he pounded the chest, the arterial pressure went up. And he pounded it again, and it went up again. And that was the beginning of closed chest massage. So that was a horrendous development that I watched. I was working on bilirubin metabolism next door, but I watched these three people really develop CPR, and that was something. That probably was more important than minimally invasive, but since that time, I think probably minimally invasive surgery.
Number four, if you didn't become a surgeon, I know you said you fell into line with your father, but looking back, if you weren't a surgeon, what do you think you would have done?
Well, the only thing people used to ask me when I was chair, if you couldn't be chair, what would you be? And I said, first of all, I got the best job in the world. There's no better job, so I'm not sure I'd do anything. But if I could switch, maybe I would switch with Cal Ripken. Cal Ripken was in the midst of his great career. And I said, maybe, I'm not even sure I would switch with Cal Ripken. But I don't know what I would be. Probably a lawyer. I always did well in school, and the law sort of interested me. But I think the second choice is so far distant from being a surgeon. Being a surgeon is the best job in the world. I don't know why everybody doesn't want to be a surgeon. So number two is so far distant that I even hesitate to pick one.
Now, Cal Ripken, the shortstop or the third base or the DH? Which one are we talking about here, sir?
He never DH'd.
Oh, he didn't? I thought he DH'd the end of his career.
No. Yeah. He was a third baseman when he came up. And Earl Weaver, he came up his rookie season, and during spring training, after Earl Weaver watched him field third base, he said to somebody, he looks like he's someone who's come down from a higher league. So he was a great fielding third baseman. He also was a great fielding shortstop. He was a big guy and not the usual prototype of a shortstop at that time. But he was a big guy who positioned himself perfectly, and he had seasons in which he didn't make a single error. Seasons. So he was an incredible fielding third baseman and shortstop, besides being a very steady player who obviously broke Lou Gehrig's longevity record. And he was a very good hitter who hit 25, 30 home runs a year.
And I'm guessing you're not a Tigers fan, even growing up in Michigan. You're probably...
I still am a big fan of the Tigers and Lions, but I'm a bigger fan of the Orioles and Ravens.
Great. Our final question is, if you could go back in time and meet yourself on the first day of internship, what piece of advice would you give yourself?
You know, that's a very good question. About 10 or 15 years ago, I started reading, for casual reading, biographies. And I wish I had started reading biographies as a young person. I know I would have been a better person and a more productive person. Reading biographies about any successful person, whether it's Albert Einstein, in which there are several great biographies. Walter Isaacson is a biographer who wrote one. He wrote another one on Ben Franklin, which is fantastic. He also wrote the one more recently on Stephen Jobs, and you read that to find out what you shouldn't do. But most biographies are about great people, and I think young people should start reading biographies and autobiographies early, because I think you can learn how great people led their lives and how you could have been a better person and been more productive by reading biographies.
Well, Dr. Cameron, we cannot thank you enough for taking the time out this morning to join us on Behind the Knife. And I know I speak for Kevin and Jason for just truly thanking you for this wonderful exploration and examination of your career and your thoughts. And thank you again, and we hope to maybe have you back someday.
Okay, good luck to you.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, that's it for us today. Time for our closing count. Thank you for joining us at Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Special thanks to Dr. Cameron for sharing with us his wisdom and experiences as it relates to pancreatic cancer. Join us next time as we go behind the knife for another in-depth discussion from one of our leaders in the field. Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindthenife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience, so give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. We're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct. Fash is closed and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.